Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Codex Magica by Tex Mars, right after this. You know, marriage is a state-licensed business. It's a three-party limited general partnership between you, your spouse, and the state. And like any other state-licensed enterprise, it is regulated by the Welfare Department, the Department of Family Services, and the Family Court. Now, the best part about all of this is that you have no input into or say-so over the marriage, divorce, dissolution, custody, alimony, child support, protective custody, or restraining orders. But you get to pay for all of the above, and if you fail to pay, you go to jail. Marriage is the most important and expensive contract that you can engage in. It's more binding, and it's more costly than your military enlistment or your 30-year home mortgage. And you probably know less about it than you do your military obligation or your house payments. Now, about 67% of all marriages end in divorce in this country, but whether you're a husband or a wife, you do have rights, privileges, and immunities to advance, to protect, or to defend against any breach of this marriage contract. That's why you should know and understand the terms and conditions of your marriage contract before you marry. And you should write that contract instead of letting the state write it for you. So whether you're married or not, why don't you write for my general law CD tapes, right? They're on CD set, and let me share some vital information with you about the law and this marriage contract. For a free copy, just call direct 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for that free four-hour commentary on the law school. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. And just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Codex Magica. We're talking about the occult leaders, people here in the United States who are into occult or witchcraft. John Kerry and George Bush, the 2004 presidential candidates, were both members of Skull and Bones. It's an occult witchcraft organization. These people, once they reach political office, like George Bush won the election, so George Bush gets to appoint the people who are going to sit on the Supreme Court, and then appoint judges who are going to man our federal district courts. And these people are all Masons. They all belong to the occult also. I once had a conversation with Helen Chenoweth over our daughter when she was about 16. I asked Helen if she thought that it would be a good idea for our daughter to go to Washington for a year as a page. And there's a program, you know, for young people. And this was just after that page scandal where, you know, they're using these pages, you know, as sex toys and sex objects there in Washington. They're called interns. And she said to me, now this is a woman who is a member of Congress, she said to me that she wouldn't send her daughter to Washington, D.C. to participate in the page program. And I asked her why, and she said, well, from her experience, she'd been in Congress 3 terms, and she said that from her experience, that about half of the members of Congress are pedophiles or they're sexual deviants, nor they're sodomites. I said to her, it was almost dumbfounding. I said, you belong to an organization that you yourself say is staffed by about half sodomites, pedophiles, and sexual deviants? And she said, yeah, that's right. And you wouldn't send your daughter to Washington, D.C.? And she said, absolutely not. Well, naturally, I didn't send my daughter either. But I wondered, how did it get that way? How do you get all those people in Washington, D.C. sitting in the Congress? And half of them are sexual deviants. Well, what you do over a long period of time, you keep electing people who belong to organizations that support that kind of behavior. Now, let's take Bill Clinton, for instance. Bill Clinton has some fairly liberal sexual mores, wouldn't you agree? Well, then, when Bill Clinton goes to appoint somebody to a political office, do you think he's going to go to the Southern Baptist Conference and start looking around for somebody, you know, that's sexually, you know, up on the up and up? Do you think he's going to go to the Mormon Church to look for family values when he goes to appoint somebody to the Supreme Court or the federal bench or to as an ambassador, you know, someplace? Or do you think maybe he's going to appoint people who have the same moral principles or the same moral standards that he has? You know, you don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar or a rocket scientist to figure out that Bill Clinton is going to, as the old saying go, birds of a feather flock together. Now, outside the Justice Department building in Washington, D.C., believe it or not, in front of the Department of Justice building in Washington is a statue of a Confederate general. His name is Albert Pike. Now, Albert Pike served as a sovereign grand commander of Scottish Rite Freemasonry in the southern jurisdiction. Now, fascinating, isn't it, that black leaders like Louis Farrakhan and Jesse Jackson are not complaining about this statue to a southern general is sitting on federal property in Washington, D.C. Now, they complain about the Stars and Bars flags, and they complain about all of the southern oppression of the blacks, and they've got nothing good to say about the South and southerners. And if a southerner says something, they'll jump right on it. Now, here's a statue, and it's a pretty good-sized statue, sitting here in Washington, D.C., on federal property. And Jesse Jackson and Louis Farrakhan have said nothing about it. And usually these two guys go nuts complaining about Confederate monuments and statues on government land. Could it be that their silence is attributed to the fact that Jesse Jackson and Louis Farrakhan are themselves 33rd degree Masons? Now remember, it was Albert Pike that wrote the Bible of Freemasonry here in America. It's called Morals and Dogma. And remember, it was Albert Pike that says on page 647 of Morals and Dogma that the 30th degree is where all Masons learn. When you get to the 30th degree, you learn that you are worshiping Lucifer, Satan, the devil. It's devil worship. Satanic. Now, that's a religion, and it's a religious ideology. And, of course, people are entitled to freedom of religion. First Amendment to our Constitution guarantees everybody that right. But are you really sure that you want to participate in demonism and witchcraft? I mean, if you want to, you know, that's your choice in life, and you can get right after it. But if you've been practicing witchcraft, and you really didn't intend to, but it just kind of worked out that way, you might want to make some kind of a change. You know, at some point in the future, you might say, I think I'll drop out of this. Now, the department statue is a Masonic female figure representing Lady Justice holding a banner with the 33rd degree double-headed eagle and the triangle of Freemasonry. Now, we've been discussing here a number of these symbols. It can be handshakes, it can be the double-headed eagle, it can be triangles. There's all kinds of symbols in the occult. And here's one called the All-Seeing Eye, and you've probably seen this many, many times. The All-Seeing Eye is on the CBS logo. And it isn't surprising because many, many of these logos that you see, such as Exxon, E-X-X-O-N, the double cross. And then the all-seeing eye that you see here on the CBS logo is also on the $1 bill. It's on top of the Great Pyramid that's in the seal of the United States here on our $1 bill. It's called the all-seeing eye. It's a very important occultic symbol. The shell that you see in the Shell Oil logo, you know, it's made to depict a seashell, which, you know, in your mind, you look back, seashells, and oil comes from fossils. You know, if you went to school like I did, that's what they were telling us in those days. And so they have this shell. Actually, that's not what that is. It's not a shell. It's the sun. It's the rising sun. Just like the Japanese, you know, they worship the sun. They're sun worshipers. And that shell, they put some ridges in it. But all of the occult members, they recognize that as the sun because they are sun worshipers. And, of course, Christians have been converted to sun worship on Easter sunrise morning. I know Easter morning. They go out and worship the sun. Now, they call it the S-O-N of God. They're worshiping the Son of God because he was resurrected on Easter Sunday morning. Now, the truth be known, Jesus wasn't resurrected on Easter Sunday morning. He was resurrected in the late afternoon on Sabbath. And on Sunday morning, when they arrived at the tomb, he was risen, past tense. And so the religious people said, well, that's why we practice going to church on Sunday instead of on the Sabbath. And that's why we celebrate Easter sunrise service to commemorate Jesus rising, you know, from the grave on Sunday morning. There's a reason behind it all. It may or may not be true, but then, you know, that's for public consumption. But those that know what that shell is, it's the rising sun. That's what it depicts. Now, in this case here, the riddle of the great seal of the United States and the all-seeing eye of the Illuminati serpent of wisdom, which is on the CBS logo, that all-seeing eye that you see there at the bottom of the screen, you know, every time Katie Couric comes on. In this case here, Tex Mars starts off, he says, what's the true meaning of the curious arcane symbols found in the Great Seal of the United States? And who designed this fantastic two-sided device, and why is it so prominently featured as art and decor on our most common item of currency, the U.S. $1 bill? Well, in answering this riddle, the symbols on the Great Seal at first glance seem to be incompatible with our history, political organization, and religious heritage. And it's an Egyptian pyramid. So what has that got to do with America? Strange Latin inscriptions upon it. And we speak English, not Latin. A bizarre all-seeing eye radiated by the sun's rays sitting on top of this pyramid. With Latin writing. It's pretty odd indeed. And it's truly weird, especially is the fact that there are two sides to the Great Seal. The front side pictures a strong, war-ready eagle with a constellation of stars and a cloud above its head. On the reverse, the mystical side is the one with the pyramid, Latin inscriptions, and the all-seeing eye. Why two sides? After all, a seal is like a rubber stamp. It is used to authenticate documents to prove authenticity and affirm veracity and genuineness. You don't need a reverse side on a rubber stamp. In fact, both sides of the Great Seal, each with various images, have been around since the days of the Continental Congress. In 1776, just hours after the Declaration of Independence was formally adopted, a committee composed of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams met to design the Great Seal. They invited an artist, a fellow by the name of Pierre Eugène de Cimetière, S-I-M-I-T-I-E-R-E, Cimetière, I would submit, to join them, and a design was approved. But the Continental Congress failed to approve it. So in 1782, Congress called on William Barton, an authority on symbols and heraldry, and Charles Thompson, Secretary of Congress, to help sort out the process. And finally, out came the current two-sided Great Seal. Now that, of course, is the official version of events, but some claim that a mysterious man from Europe, but having and living in Philadelphia, a guy by the name of Haim Solomon, secretly assisted the committee of Franklin, Jefferson, and Adams. Haim Solomon, a Jewish banker, just happened to be the American representative for the Rothschilds in Europe. Solomon, it is said, bribed a number of American politicians and was able to get about anything that he and his mentors wanted. And in the case of the Great Seal, the Rothschilds wanted symbols to be pictured in the Great Seal of the United States befitting the aims of the Illuminati. Though Jewish and Zionist in ambition, the Rothschilds were not worshippers of the God of the Old and New Testaments of the Bible. They were Sabbatan Frankist, or satanic in theology, and they sought, and still seek today, a Jewish utopia or kingdom on planet Earth. The kingdom would be the New Age successor to ancient Babylon and Egypt. It would be a powerhouse nation that would, through magic and intellect, conquer the world. America would be its proxy. America would be its alter ego. America then must be fashioned into a Kabbalistic Jewish state. All hail the new Egypt, the new empire of the ages, child of the sun god of the ancients. America, the new Jerusalem, must unite with old Jerusalem, and the Zionist Illuminati must reign. Rothschild's agent, Haim Solomon, had millions of dollars of largesse to spread around in bribes, and so he did. A good portion of the money went to fund the Continental Congress and its operations. Some went into the Treasury for the Revolutionary War. Some went into politicians' pockets. Rothschild eventually got the images that he had demanded on the Great Seal, though not with opposition, or not without opposition. The design was bitterly opposed by the few who recognized the Masonic and Illuminist elements. And as for Haim Solomon, few history textbooks mention him at all. But he is privately called by Illuminati Jews the financier of the American Revolution. Only recently, scattered bits of propaganda have begun to be floated about him. A few Jewish books speak of his grand accomplishments, offering a more cheery and less honest version of his life and his activities as banker for the American Revolution. The ultimate goal of the Illuminati is to eventually bring Haim Solomon out of the closet, so to speak. Someday his name will be in lights. He will be immortalized in print, in movies, and on TV as a great and noble hero, something akin to George Washington or Thomas Jefferson. Statues will be built to honor him, and one already has in Philadelphia. Mark my words and mark your calendar for the future and see if what I tell you isn't so. Now let's examine the symbols on America's Great Seal and see if we can make sense of their true esoteric meaning and purpose. So let's wipe away the gloss and get down to the base surface to better understand. This is vital because of the future of the United States and the destiny of all humanity hanging in a balance. And it's wrapped up and is revealed and is a collection of illuminist symbols and marks. Now, Masonry is a peculiar Egyptian-Babylonian-Jewish institution. And so the pyramid itself harkens back to the dynasty of the pharaohs and to the gods and goddesses of ancient Egypt. The stones which make up the pyramid are also of esoteric significance. And in the Masonic philosophy, it is taught that enlightened man is in a rude natural state, having little or no light, and without the spiritual illumination offered by the mystery religions, he is likened to an imperfect or rough ashlar stone. But once enlightened and illuminated, he is crafted into a man of education, sophistication, discipline, and culture. He reaches upward toward spiritual perfection. He is then a perfect ashlar stone. In many pagan religions, this concept of the rough versus perfect ashlar was taught, and in Freemasonry, it is heavily emphasized. The pyramid structure is fitted only with perfect ashlar stones, and it is said meticulously chosen by the builders who watch for flaws and reject the rough or imperfect ashlar. Likewise, the higher level Masons discover that the pyramid reflects or parallels the New World Order. That's why the words Novus Ordo Seclorum. They and their illuminized superiors are building under the watchful eye of the great architect of the universe, Satan, whose secret and sacred name the Royal Archmason, learns is Jabalon, or Satan, or Lucifer. The builders, the perfect ashlars, then, are the Illuminati and their minions. Their building project is the renovation and reconstruction of the whole earth. And, of course, in order to build this new deal of the ages, they must first tear down the old. Civilization as we know it today must be raised and destroyed by dialectic chaos so that the new world order may be ushered in. Ordo ab chao. Order out of chaos. It is when this ambitious goal is achieved that symbolically the capstone will be set in place atop the pyramid. Then he who lies within the living stone shall come forth to rule. The phoenix, Satan, and his son shall rise from the flames of destruction just as the legendary phoenix bird arose. The phoenix, however, is in reality a cockatrice, a dragon bird, a flying serpent. The word pyramid, incidentally, literally means amidst the fire. And now you know the true occultic meaning of the word. Now, peering into the all-seeing eye, simply put, Freemasons, under the direction of Haim Solomon, Ben Franklin, and others, designed the Great Seal with its all-seeing eye in the capstone amidst the radiant sun background. As followers of Egyptianism, it has long been assumed that the eye is that of Osiris, the Egyptian sun god, and or his son Horus. This is true, but there's much more than that. Osiris, of course, was worshipped as the sun. Albert Pike, the former Sovereign Grand Commander, wrote, quote, "The sun is the all-seeing eye in our lodges." And Pike goes on to say that, quote, "The blazing star, the pentagram deity, has been recognized as an emblem of omniscience, or the all-seeing eye, which is to the ancients was the sun." Now, the Illuminati and their subordinates, the Masons, honor the deity of countless names. And yes, one of those names is Osiris, with his son Horus. But the Illuminati deity is a concealed god who hides his true identity in a multitude of disguises and subterfuges. He is called the Sun, the Central Sun, Hiram Abiff, the one with the ineffable name, Ein Sof, the great architect of the universe, Abaddon, Mahabon, and Jebulun. Ostensibly, the Illuminati worship a pantheon, a multiplicity of gods, but not so. These are all fronts for the elite worship of Lucifer. He is their true god. He is their god of light. And as Albert Pike stated in Morals and Dogma, doubt it not. Now, the Masonic god is the serpent, and the Bible in Isaiah 14 and Revelation 12, verse 9, identifies Lucifer as the great dragon, the serpent called the devil, and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. So by whatever name you call him, the god of the Illuminati and Masonry is the serpent. In fact, in A Bridge to Light, an official textbook of the Supreme Mother Council, 33rd degree, the highest council of the Scottish Rite, Rex Hutchins, a 33rd degree Mason, reveals that the body of the Holy Spirit, the universal agent, is none other than the serpent devouring his own tail. That is the Ouroboros serpent. That's a circle with a snake with his tail in his mouth as he's consuming himself. Now remember, in all of their writings, the most reverend or revered of Masonic scholars, Manly P. Hall, Albert Mackey, Albert Pike, all claim that the Masonic rituals and teachings come from the mysteries of ancient Babylon, Egypt, Greece, and Persia. Thus, we glean understanding when we read in Earth's Earliest Ages this statement by G. Pember. He said, "There is little doubt that the culmination of the mysteries was the worship of Satan himself." Now, you'll also recall our discussion elsewhere in this book that the Illuminist and the Masonic theology is solidly based on the Jewish Kabbalah. Indeed, almost all occult and magical belief systems are founded upon the principles and teachings of the Jewish Kabbalah. And in her most famous book, The Secret Doctrine, Helena Blavatsky praised Satan as the teacher of humanity. "He is to be thanked," Blavatsky says, "for setting men on the path to divinity and liberty. It is," she emphasizes, "the Kabbalah that unveils the secret." To what secret is she referring? Listen, as Blavatsky flatly states, "The core doctrine of the mysteries of occultism, of Illuminism, is that the great serpent of the Garden of Eden and the Lord God are identical." Ah, now we have it. We have here the reality of supreme evil in this core teaching. The Apostle Paul knew of this mystery teaching, and he wrote of the mystery of iniquity, and he said of the ancient religionists of his day that they knew God, but they glorified him not as God, and they changed the glory of God into the likeness of creeping things. Creeping things, that is, serpents. And he said that in Romans 1, verse 23. Now, Barbara Walker, the researcher of occultism and paganism, writes, "As Lord of Death, Osiris was sometimes identified with the great serpent of the underworld, and sometimes he was painted in the same serpentine form, bent around so his toes touched his head. The serpent, or Satan, as we know from the scriptures, is God of the dead. Indeed, God says, 'All they that hate me love death,' in Proverbs 8, verse 36. He is Lord, all right, but only of death, of the underworld, and of planet Earth for a season, as we see in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Satan is graphically pictured in the occult world as a serpent biting his own tail. How appropriate. A devourer of himself. And that is what actually happens when a person defies God and worships the adversary. He or she is biting his own tail, tragically and pathetically, devouring himself. Now, the Ouroboros, O-R-O-B-O-R-O-S, or serpent biting its own tail, is pictured on the cover of Codex Magica. This book unmasks the Illuminati worship of the detestable creature, a worship of which virtually every person on planet Earth is dangerously and hopelessly unaware, since the Illuminati, Masons, and fellow Kabbalists have amassed such tremendous political, financial, social, and technological powers. It is not, or is it not, rather, a frightening thing to realize that these men are not only religious, but their religion is Satanism, and their God is the devil. The destructive path, therefore, is the way of the Illuminati. And as I have demonstrated, these wicked agents of the serpent are psychopaths and present a clear and present danger and a threat to all of our lives. But the gravest danger is that which confronts the souls of billions of ignorant human beings. And if they fall for this lie about the serpent, they will suffer destruction. Now, one form of the circle is a serpent with a tail in its mouth. It is the return to unity. The true circle symbolizes evolution. The serpent circle, involution. The power brings unity out of diversity. The serpent circle is therefore ever the symbol of the destructive. Later, in the photos and illustrations presented in this chapter, you will discover the startling artwork on a Jewish New Year's postcard by Jewish artist Alan Roth back in 1915. And the design shows the Ouroboros, the serpent, Satan, encircling and conquering the whole earth. Happy New Year. As I have proven over and over by the preponderance of documentations, we cannot separate these murderous goals and activities of the Illuminati from their religious belief system. Their inspiration, their fanatical zealotry, comes from their teacher, Satan, who has given them a thorough set of instructions, an unholy Bible, if you will, in the Jewish Kabbalah. In this unholy Bible, the serpent plays the key role. He is praised as the serpent of wisdom, the destiny of the Illuminati, and the whole world is said to be in his hands. In fact, there is a song that says he has the whole world in his hands. They're not just whistling Dixie. So we thank God that all who believe in Christ Jesus have no part of this destiny. Jesus said he has chosen us out of the world. We're the pilgrims, the aliens on earth, spiritually residing in heavenly places. Well, the serpent has no power or control whatsoever over us, and he and we solidly reject his many works. That's the works of Satan, among which, regrettably, is the symbology of the Great Seal of the United States. Now, the balance of the chapter is made up of, probably 50 or 75 photos. And graphic details of snakes and crosses and people making signs and symbols and the all-seeing eye and various and sundry other witchcraft phenomena that you've seen over and over. You see this in art everywhere. And, of course, you see it in the logo of the all-seeing eye of CBS television. We're at the midway point. We've got to give you a reminder here that the Law Hour and Editorial Review is what you're listening to here. And the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Keep in mind that these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend will necessarily endorse or recommend the Law Hour and editorial review. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are back to Codex Magica, book written by Tex Mars. If you want to spell his name when you go into Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble or somebody, it's T-E-X-E. Kind of an odd spelling, T-E-X-E, Tex Mars, M-A-R-R-S, Tex Mars. He's written a number of books, 37 according to the fly cover on this book. Lives in Austin, Texas. And I couldn't find anything here that was out of place or that was incorrect. You know, we take certain statements and certain ideas, you know, or statements or facts, you know, that are listed in a book, and then we go check them out and see, well, was that correct? And we do that, you know, a little section here, a little section there, and we keep moving around, and we're looking for, we're probing for weak spots, we're trying to find mistakes and errors, and trying to determine whether or not this book has any flaws in it that we wouldn't want to repeat. I'm just flipping through the book here, and I'm on page 359, and here's Teresa Hines, John Kerry's heiress wife. Is she a loose cannon or crazy like a fox? Well, she was pictured on the cover of Newsweek magazine. And Teresa Hines Carey, the fabulously rich heiress of a colonialist fortune, who married two, count them, two U.S. senators, who were each initiates of Skull and Bones. John Hines and John Carey. That's Teresa married Carey after Hines was killed in a mysterious airplane crash. Now, Teresa, who is a Jewess, whose maiden name was Samoz Ferreira, is a board member of the Illuminati-run Carnegie Institute. It's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and a member of the Brookings Institute. All three of these are Illuminati institutions. Did you get that again? Carnegie Institute, Council on Foreign Relations, and the Brookings Institute. That's Teresa. All right, now this book is just filled with hundreds of little eye-opening pieces of information like that. I never would have known anything about Teresa Hines unless it had been reported. Somebody's got to report to somebody. And of course, now, is that true? And then when you check that out, you find out, oh yeah, that is true. Look at that. She is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. In fact, if you write to the Council on Foreign Relations, they'll send you an updated membership list, free of charge. We got one here. I don't know about the Bilderbergers. They're a little bit more secretive, but there are other of these institutions here. They're pretty upfront, you know. They just come right out and tell you, this is what, where it's at. And then once in a while, you'll get an insider, you know, that spills the beans, like an Anthony Sutton, you know, who writes a book and says, hey, let me tell you more about the Illuminati and what they're up to. And I don't think that the average guy thinks very much about this practice of witchcraft. But, you know, witchcraft is a capital felony. It's definitely prohibited in Scripture. You know, God told us not to practice that witchcraft. And there's a number of different ways that you can practice witchcraft. I mean, there's just, you know, 17 I think I've got here in my list. And people will practice witchcraft in one or more of those 17 ways. Just one or more of them. All right, now there's another section over here. It's, let's see if I can find it. Lightning on page 557. So let me flip over here to page 557. Lightning has quite a bit to do with the occult. So let me read that little section to you. Page 557. Lightning, fall from heaven. You ever heard that statement in the Scripture where Jesus said in Luke 10, verses 18 and 19, he says, I beheld Satan like or as lightning fall from heaven. Now, you know, it's just one of those offhanded statements that you read in the scripture, but what does it mean? And how does it fit into the occult, this thing of lightning? Well, lightning has long been a supreme symbol of Lucifer, whom the Illuminati deemed to be their enlightener. Well, in the Bible, Jesus says, "I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven," in Luke 10, verse 18. And we also discover in the scripture that Lucifer is called the prince of the power of the air, in Ephesians 2, verse 2. The pagan mystery religions from which the modern Illuminati have borrowed picture their supreme god as a fiery, flying serpent, bringing lightning and thunder in his wake. The Greeks and Romans worshipped angry deities, such as Zeus and Jupiter, sitting on a throne at the hub of the heavens, throwing lightning bolts and booming thunder at their enemies. The modern revival of the use of the lightning symbol is seen by the Nazis, the symbol of rock music groups, and in the Harry Potter books and movies. Once again, we also see the phallic symbol recognized, this time as lightning, in the Illuminist religion. This originated from the tantric tradition in which it is taught that lightning is a phallic scepter, jewel lingam, or magical wand of the gods. Lightning especially symbolizes the Hindu fire god, Agni, whose mark is given by his high priests and priestesses, or priestess, in the third eye religion of the forehead between the eyes. Have you ever noticed those Hindu women? They all have this red dot between their eyes. I often wondered, why do they do that? What does that symbolize? What does that mean? And you find all these Hindu women have it. And that's their sun god. They're worshiping their sun god, and that's their little red orb there on between their eyes. So the lightning bolt, then, is the sign of Zeus, the father of the mythological deities of Greece. The Nordic peoples worshipped him and called him Odin. O-D-I-N. O-D-I-N. Odin. Now, you'll see this lightning bolt on the forehead of Harry Potter. Here's Satanism, live and direct. And we teach this to our children under the guise of, well, it's good they're learning how to read. Excuse me, they couldn't learn to read from the Wall Street Journal or from U.S. News and World Report. They have to learn to read from a occultic, satanic book on witchcraft. Your children, boys and girls, will learn whatever it is you want to teach them, and if you want to teach them witchcraft, that's your choice in life, but are you really sure that you want your children to learn witchcraft? Maybe it's fun. Well, I'm sure it is. A girl down at Flo's Whorehouse is a lot of fun. You don't go to a whorehouse because it feels bad. You go to a whorehouse because it feels real good. But the ends thereof are the ways of death. That's the place where you get AIDS, herpes, and VD down at Flo's place, So just because something feels good doesn't necessarily mean that it's good for you. Tuck that one away in your heart. Now, there's another little thing over here. It's called the V sign. Remember Winston Churchill? He used to walk around all the time holding his hand up in the air with his first two fingers forked in a V. And, of course, most people think that's the V for victory. Well, Winston Churchill was an insider. He was an occultist. Don't be real surprised, because almost all of the idle rich and their political appointees are also occultists. Victory for the devil. Fabulous exploits of Sir Winston Churchill and other druid priests and Illuminati servants. A remarkable thing occurred with the hand so lifted is that its shadow resembles the head and horns of the great Baphomet, the symbol of black magic. When you hold your hand up and form that V, it's the symbol of black magic. Did you know that? Boy, will you have something to talk about over dinner tonight. Now, Britain's legendary World War II Prime Minister, Sir Winston Churchill, made the V sign famous. It was standard for the cigar-smoking, paunchy politician. He flashed the V sign every chance he got, and news photographers captured hundreds of photographs of Churchill giving the sign. It was generally thought that in doing so, the pugnacious Churchill was signaling confidence in eventual victory over the Nazi foe across the channel. So the sign of two fingers pointed upward in a V shape became universally accepted as a sign for victory. But it's really the sign of the horned god Pan. But what the majority of people believe to be conventional wisdom is often wrong. Such is the case here, too, for this sign. In reality, it is the sign of ancient origins, and it is, in fact, a sign of Satan, of the horned god Pan, and it's worse. Now, Panorama magazine, it's Paranoia magazine. Paranoia magazine, an interesting publication which bills itself as the conspiracy reader, had a picture some years back of Churchill displaying his famous V. An astute reader, knowledgeable of dark things, wrote a letter to the editor in the next issue commenting on Churchill and his sign. Nigel Cornwall of Britain wrote, "The sign, I believe, has its origins as a symbol for a pagan horned god." Cornwall also suggested that when the sign is given with the palm inside, it is recognized as a horribly vulgar and offensive gesture, signifying penetration of both body orifices. Done in the typical fashion, this sign literally means intercourse by the devil, to be violated sexually by the horned god. The thumb holding down the fingers creates the vulva, while the two largest fingers pointing up are the horns of the god Satan. Now, in her highly regarded Encyclopedia of Symbols entitled Masonic and Occult Symbols, illustrated by Kathy Burns, she explores the meaning of the V sign, and she explains that the two fingers upward relate to the Masonic and Gnostic law of opposites, exactly as the case for the Masonic Lodge's black and white checkerboard floors. This is the doctrine of bringing order out of chaos, of reconciling the two opposites, evil and good, with Satan reigning over both heaven and hell. The V sign is also a sign of the horned god of witchcraft, often called Pan or Baphomet, androgynous, I guess that's androgynous, male and female, goat god, again illustrating the law of opposites. Now, the complete book of witchcraft explains further the occult meaning. When the sign is given to produce a shadow behind a diabolical image, it appears that seems to be the face of the devil. Witches and magicians and some Catholic popes use this image to affect emotional responses. Now, this was a deeply seated belief in the fascination or enchantment of shadows, so that the witch or magician could use them to either produce sickness and death or to inspire love. The shadow of the satanic priest's fingers raised in blessing was considered to have evil significance. A remarkable thing occurred with the hand so lifted is that its shadow resembles the head and horns of the goat of Baphomet, the symbol of black magic. And the use of the shadow of blessing was regarded as the legitimate prerogative of the Pope and was most terribly exercised during the Dark Ages and at the time of the Inquisition. Interestingly, other authoritative sources say that the V sign, the sign of the horny goat or horned goat, is practiced even today in satanic covens as a symbol of satanic benediction. In times past, it was just the opposite, being a sign of evil, of malediction. But today, the twisted minds of satanic worshippers view evil as something good and desirable. What is malediction to the holy and righteous, to the Satanists, is a wonderful thing. Now, the V sign as displayed by the hand is also used by illuminists in the form of the letter V with two straight lines angled to meet at a point facing downward. It becomes a V device or chevron and has been adopted for the uniforms of military troops of some countries, including the United States, resembling a downward pointing triangle with the top line open or omitted, and it symbolizes fiery destruction and wrath on the object at which it is pointed. Now, about 12 years ago, a few Satan worshippers arrived secretly in the darkness at my ministry building and evidently carried out a ritual. Well, for many months, we had received anonymous telephone threats, so it wasn't a big surprise. Well, on the concrete porch near our front door, the vandals had scratched a V pointing to the entrance, and there were signs of candle use and the burning of objects. Here we see the fantastic beliefs of these occultists that their rituals celebrate reality. However, in vainly attempting to harm a true Christian ministry, I'm persuaded that the magic backfired. When God is your protector, those who cast Satan's spells end up in deep, deep trouble. Now, there is the number 6, or the numerical number 666. So, as we have previously seen, the Jewish Kabbalah is at the root of most wicked systems of magic. The Kabbalah, spelled C-A-B-A-L-A, or sometimes spelled K-A-B-B-A-L-A-H, is a font of doctrine for Freemasonry and for many other secret societies. Now, we can expect, therefore, that the V sign is also emphasized by the rabbinical priests of Kabbalism. And in fact, we find that the rabbis teach that the meaning of the Hebrew letter for V, V-A-U, is Nail, N-A-I-L, and Nail is a secret title for Satan. Its corrupt meaning comes from the nails driven into the hands of Jesus being crucified. V-A-U, or V, is the sixth letter in the Hebrew alphabet, and of course the book of Revelation reveals that the name of the beast, or Antichrist, is coded with a number of 666, or 666. Now, Winston Churchill was a Druid priest. So where did Winston Churchill learn of the satanic powers of the V sign? Very few people are aware that Churchill was a Freemason. Stephen Knight wrote an explosive expose of the Brotherhood that rocked the British Isles when it was published some 15 years ago. In it, he unmasked many British nobles, police, judges, and politicians who were Masons, among them Winston Churchill, who, Knight documented, was initiated in 1903 at Lodge No. 3000 of the United Lodge of Great Britain. However, even fewer people are aware that Churchill was not only a Mason, but a Druid priest. Dr. Stanley Monteith, occult and secret society researcher and host of Radio Liberty in California, states that Churchill was an adept of the occult, having been introduced and inducted into the Druids in 1908, and having pledged the occult oaths required of those who have entered into the world of Freemasonry. Monteith's sobering statements are backed up by Miranda J. Green in The World of the Druids, and by John Daniels' Scarlet and the Beast, two excellent resource books. And then there are the rites of the Druid witchcraft sect. The rites and ceremonies of the Druid witchcraft sect, which has chapters both in Great Britain and in the United States, are remarkably similar to those of Freemasonry. They harken back to the ancient mystery religions. Now, some scholars are convinced that human sacrifice was practiced by the Druids. Julius Caesar, Roman general who conquered Britain for Imperial Rome, wrote of how brutal and furiously savage were the people under the influence of the Druid priesthood. He also described the horror of the rite in which the Druid priests and Druid people would periodically choose a victim to be confined inside of a huge wicker effigy. The wicker was then set ablaze and the human victim consumed by the flames as the people celebrated and paraded in a circle carrying candles. Even today, at the ruins of Stonehenge in England, modern-day Druids meet on festival occasions, wearing the appropriate white garb and carrying out rites and worship of the ancient gods. Meanwhile, in Nevada each year, hundreds of thousands attend the incredible Burning Man Festival, at which the sacrificial ritual of the burning wicker man is recreated. And amazingly, the British press recently carried news reports, including pictures of the Druid initiation of a man, Rowan Williams, who just happened to be the Archbishop of Canterbury, head of the Church of England. Williams told reporters that he saw no incompatibility in his duties as a pagan Druid priest and those that he has assumed as Archbishop of the presumably Christian Anglican Church of England. This is yet one more bit of evidence as to how apostate and corrupt the global Christian establishment is today. And while it is true that the true Christian church, though tiny in numbers, lives on and is undefeated, the majority of modern-day pastors, ministers, and churchmen have departed from the faith, departed from the scripture, and they have no concept at all of genuine Christian doctrine. The spectacle of the top, so-called Christian clergymen of the entire British Commonwealth, Archbishop Williams being initiated as a wizard in the Druid witchcraft sect and publicly boasting of it, is proof positive that the devil and his Illuminati have become the unacknowledged masters who run the Christian establishment behind the scenes. The big-name clergy and the big-name evangelists today merely follow the script laid down for them by their elite controllers. Now, in the book Codex Magica, there are about 1,000 pictures. I mean, photographs, actual pictures of our political leaders. Here's former President George Herbert Walker Bush. This is Bush Sr. And he lets insiders know of the goal and eventual total victory of the Zionist Illuminati by blatantly displaying the Kabbalistic V sign. The position of Bush's left arm is further indicative, an indication of the Kabbalistic nature of the sign. Inside the pages of the magazine, there was not one shred of explanation as to why the senior Bush was pictured on the cover giving this sign, nor was it an election year. Moreover, the former president was in retirement, proving the elite adage, once a servant of the Illuminati, always a servant. This is the politics issue of Texas Monthly, George Bush Sr. on the cover, giving the V sign. And then Franklin D. Roosevelt was both a 32nd degree Mason and a Kabbalist. As his family tree clearly demonstrates, Roosevelt's ancestors came from the Netherlands and were of Jewish blood lineage. Just a little aside there. Well, we're about out of time here. I'm going to have to give you a final reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to get yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you next time, tomorrow night. God willing, of course, right here. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.